Welcome to Trailblazers, where we explore the inspiring journeys of entrepreneurs and industry leaders who are redefining success and making a lasting impact. These game changers are driving progress in our region and around the world. Thank you for joining us on another edition of Trailblazers. I'm your host, Melody Bradford. Throughout history, women have often been the caregivers, the nurturers, the champions of everyone else's health and well-being. But what happens when women themselves need guidance, answers, and support through one of life's most significant transitions? Today, we're joined by a physician, educator, advocate, and leader who has dedicated her career to helping women navigate every stage of life, from childbirth to menopause and beyond. Dr. Kristen Friel is an OBGYN with Lehigh Valley Health Network, part of Jefferson Health, a graduate of Wellesley College and Harvard Medical School. She has spent more than two decades caring for women while also shaping the next generation of healthcare providers. Today, she is helping lead an important conversation around menopause, sexual health, and empowering women to advocate for themselves. But beyond the white coat, she's also a wife, a mother, educator, mentor, and someone who understands firsthand the challenges of balancing a demanding career, family life, and personal wellness. Dr. Friel, it is my absolute pleasure to welcome you to Trailblazers. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, for sure. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I have to say, I've grown up with you, right? From a perspective of when I got pregnant, you were there. When I delivered my children, you were there. Now I'm approaching menopause and you're there. I'm just so glad that I'm like that we're aging together. But you know, you have done an incredible amount of work. You have done events, you've educated women, you've answered the tough questions. I want to talk with you a little bit about your journey. Your journey began in Indiana, correct?
Yeah, that's okay. Where I was born and grew up.
Before taking you to Wellesley College and then Harvard Medical School. Looking back, what experiences first sparked your interest in medicine? How did you decide to get into it?
Yeah, sure. So as you said, I grew up in Indiana. My first job, I was 12 years old, and I was a corn detassler. So I rode a tractor very early in the morning plucked up, you know, husks from corn in the cornfields. That was the only job I could get when I was, I think, about 12 years old. And then my next job, I actually worked in a nursing home in the kitchen, and I made minimum wage back then, probably like $3.35. And that exposed me to sort of, you know, healthcare in that space. I then went on to become a nurse's aide, and that's when I really started, you know, quote unquote, helping to take care of folks. The majority of nursing home residents are women, and so I obviously took care of mostly women in that facility. I didn't come from a family of physicians. I was the first physician in my family, so I didn't really have any nurses or physicians in my family as role models or, you know, people to talk to about a medical career. So, you know, that was sort of my first foray into, like, helping to take care of people. I was somebody in high school who always loved science. I liked to learn. That was just sort of how my brain worked. I was also fortunate enough to grow up with my grandmother. I lived with her through high school, and my great-grandmother lived next door to us, so I was extremely close to my grandmother and my great-grandmother. So I sort of always had this affinity for women, strong women, that, you know, married with my interest in science, as well as, like, the helping part, which I really enjoyed. It was sort of a no-brainer for me to think about medicine. I entered college with a plan, you know, to go to medical school, so not all folks have that, but it was pretty easy for me. I was a biology major, and I was, you know, kind of pre-med, and I ended up at an all-women's college. You know, that's another story, but sort of continued my, you know, just admiration, respect for women, and then I entered medical school sort of with the intention of going into OBGYN.
Yeah, and well, and let me actually talk about that for a second there. And I know you're very humble about it, but I have to tout this. Wellesley and Harvard are two of the most respected institutions arguably in the world. How did those experiences shape your confidence, your leadership style, and even your career aspirations? Because not every leader has that backing. Why was it important for you to go to those two?
Yeah, sure. So I went to a large public high school in Carmel, Indiana. It was a great school. The focus of that high school was definitely like sports. And if you were like a smart girl, you weren't certainly in the popular crowd. And so I sort of had that experience in high school and just sort of was looking for something different. We happened to have a friend of the family who went to Smith College. Mm. She was a couple years older than I was, and she, you know, we were friendly. And so she's like, oh, you should go out, you know, go see Smith. So my mom and I went on a college trip out east. We went to Smith College, and we were actually driving into Boston to visit a couple of schools in Boston. And we're like, oh, let's go to Wellesley College. It's like on the way. To be honest, I hadn't really heard of Wellesley very much. So we went. We had a tour of the campus, talked to the folks there, and I just fell in love with the place. And so I actually applied their early decision. It was the only college I applied to. I was super surprised about getting in. I wrote a lot about my grandmother in my personal essay. And, you know, I never looked back. It was awesome. I used to go to class, you know, in pajamas and shorts. I never wore makeup. You know, the friends that I made there, the relationships developed there are still some of the closest friends that I have are the women from Wellesley. And actually only one of them is a physician. She was probably my best friend during college. So we really were able to walk through the whole pre-med, medical school application, medical school residency really together. But those relationships definitely gave me that like confidence and strength to really feel like I could do anything. And those women have like been by my side, you know, throughout my whole life since college.
And so then you went to Harvard.
Yep. Okay. So I applied to a bunch of different medical schools. You know, now when I look back, I've done a lot of like medical school student interviews, et cetera. I think, oh my gosh, I never would have gotten into Harvard. And, you know, people hear that. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, undervalue, you know, the meaning of going there. But I will tell you, I also had a really great time in medical school. And the people that I, you know, worked alongside, studied alongside, are like awesome human beings. And when I go back to reunions now, it's never about like, oh, what are you doing? What are you doing? It's all about how are you? How's your family?
Yeah.
I mean, I met my husband the first day of medical school. Okay. Some of my still really good friends are in Boston or, you know, I met that first day as well. So even though I think it sounds great on paper, it was really, I had a lot of fun in medical school, felt very supported. I thought college, to be honest, academically was harder than medical school. I sometimes hate to say that, but
wow.
we did a lot of group, you know, problem-based learning.
Uh-huh.
And so it was really about working together, supporting each other. So I did not feel super competitive as a student at Harvard Medical School. And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah. Well, and it takes a team too. So that was, you know, great background. You've shared publicly that your OBGYN rotation wasn't always smooth sailing. Was there a moment when you knew this was the specialty you were ultimately meant to pursue, or, you
yeah,
know, how did you figure that out?
Sure. I've talked about this a lot, and it in part was part of the reason why I really got into medical student education as part of my career. In when I started medical school, like I had said before, I really thought I would pursue OBGYN because of all the things that I've mentioned. And so I was super excited to do my third year rotation as medical students. During your third year, you kind of rotate through the standard specialties, medicine, pediatrics, psychiatry, surgery, and OBGYN is one of the core rotations. And so when I did that rotation, I was like, oh, everything's just going to fall into place. It's all going to make sense. It's going to be this perfect A leads to B leads to C. And then when I did my rotation, I was actually pretty miserable and pretty unhappy. And so I ended up taking a year off from medical school because I didn't really know what I wanted to do then. And I didn't, you know, leave medical school. I did this fellowship in pathology for a year. And, you know, that gave me some time and space to really reflect on what was it about that experience that was turning me away. I think it turned out I just happened to be around several residents, folks in training who just weren't very happy or very kind to medical students. And once I could separate that experience from the actual medicine and the caregiving, then I could say, oh, yeah, I really want that part of medicine. Mm-hmm. And so when I, you know, kind of got involved in medical student education, part of my mantra was I didn't want any student to have the same experience that I had when I was a third year student.
Interesting. And after more than 25 years caring for women, what continues to inspire you every day when you walk into the office?
Yeah, I think
knowing that you had all those challenges and pivot,
oh,
you know.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the unique things, and you mentioned this in your intro, that it's so, you know, amazing and awesome and humiliating and, you know, humble is, you know, as a female OBGYN, I really get to walk through with other women very, very similar experiences that I go through as a woman. And so I think that's just an incredible perspective. I say that all the good things in my job really come from patients, patients who push me, patients who challenge me, patients who show gratitude for me. It's really about those conversations and those relationships that, you know, have really led me down the variety of clinical paths that I've chosen. I also think the other unique thing about being a female OBGYN is that, you know, women in a GYN office, it's a vulnerable place to be. Having a child is vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And being able to share that that vulnerability, you know, with another female and trying to provide some, you know, some safety, some guidance is really, you know, it's extraordinary. And it's really something that I try hard not to take for granted. Mm-hmm. And to think about, you know, as I kind of get through some of the busyness and, you know, the hecticness of a busy office day or a busy day on the labor floor.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, so let's talk a little bit about, you know, I don't want to call it a pivot, but maybe like a transition or evolution of your practice, which is menopause, focusing on menopause. Menopause is finally becoming part of the mainstream conversation. Why do you think it remained misunderstood or overlooked for so many years? And talk to me a little bit about why you decided to get into that.
Sure. So, I mean, I think from a historical perspective, you know, I graduated from residency in 1999. I graduated prior to the publication of the Women's Health Initiative, which is the big trial that sort of everybody talks about. So I was fortunate enough when I was in training, I had a couple of mentors who were, you know, interested in menopause, talked to us about menopause. So when I graduated, I was comfortable with that topic based on the knowledge that we had at that time. And then there was the big trial that was published in 2002 called the Women's Health Initiative, which really turned everything upside down. If you talk to OBGYNs who are of a similar age as myself, we all pretty much remember where we were the day that the WHI was published and sort of what happened after that. And what happened after that, or what happened as a result of that, is the results of those trials were published in the New York Times, they say like above the fold, so like a very mm-hmm. prominent story
right.
that basically discussed the fact that hormone therapy increased the risk of breast cancer as well as heart disease. And after that, I distinctly remember the head of my practice at that time was, you know, running all around. We had to call the patients who were on hormone therapy. We had to, you know, send out a letter telling everybody to stop. Mm. And so it was after that that then, you know, menopause hormone therapy prescribed in a doctor's office really fell by the wayside as a result of that study. Mm. In addition, folks who were in the middle of training then also didn't get the same kind of education that I got, or certainly as we're providing today. And then as we learned more about the actual meaning of those results and how they were put forth, we understood that the data was really, you know, not presented in a true, authentic way. And, oh, by the way, women were still going through menopause. Women were still suffering. And so that's really when you had this emergence of a concept of bioidentical hormones. Mm-hmm. That's when Suzanne Summer's book, you know, was published. And it really took like 20 years before things changed. And I think there are a couple of reasons behind that.
Wow.
The first reason was there was an article published in the New York Times in 2023 by Susan Dominus, who really kind of put out there in mainstream a critical reappraisal of the WHI. At the same time, you had some celebrities coming forth in social media, on Oprah. And then after those two things, as you know, it's really taken off, and menopause is really having a moment. What's interesting, I think, is the state of knowledge of what we actually know hasn't changed that much.
Mm-hmm.
So we understand what the data means, but our new knowledge is not so different than it was many years ago.
Yeah, and so, and you know, I think there's a lot of misconceptions around menopause and
sure.
even, I mean, certainly hormone replacement therapy. People don't know what to do.
Right.
Myself included.
Right.
And many women think that menopause means hot flashes and little else. What are some of the symptoms and changes that women may not realize are connected to menopause? And I also want you to talk a little bit about, you know, your sexual health practice too, because I think that that's a large component of, you know, transitioning into menopause, what that means. Talk
sure.
to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I'll start a little bit about that. So one of the things that, again, kind of getting back to patients are really what give me my energy and give me my juice and give me my you know, inspiration to keep learning is when I first came out, unlike menopause, which I felt relatively okay talking about after residency, sexual health was not taught at all during mm-hmm. residency. And, you know, patients would come in and ask, you know, oh, I'm having low libido, having issue with orgasm, pain. And I would sort of be like, well, you know a little bit about this. Let's check this or that. But I didn't really have a framework about how to think about that or talk about that with patients. And so as a result of that, I was like, huh, this kind of keeps coming up. And part of what I would say at the end was, oh, I'm going to go to this conference. Let me see if I'm going to learn something. I'll get back to you. And I stumbled upon, in that journey, an organization called ISWICH, which stands for the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. And I went to their conference, and I was like, huh, there actually is a framework and some treatments and an approach to sexual health. Mm. And so I sort of went down that that journey and then talked to our chair at the time, who sort of gave me the opportunity to really develop a sexual health office practice. So, you know, we started doing that now, gosh, it's probably been about 10 years ago. And so certainly sexual health concerns come up, not just in menopause, for sure they come up there, but really across all ages. So I think sexual health is still something, unlike menopause, where I feel like, you know, we're a lot better off than we were years ago. Sexual health is still something that can be difficult to talk about, challenging to talk about with folks, but is something that we should all feel comfortable about bringing up in the office.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think patients are very comfortable about bringing up menopause, you know, symptoms. Sexual health, I think, is still a little bit of a taboo topic, and I'm hoping over time that will change.
And one of the questions I wanted to ask about kind of There's so many questions around menopause, right? Both for those that are trying to treat it, but also, you know, that are going through it. And when I say treat it, I mean for themselves, right? Like, and it plays into a few different things, including mental health. What are the biggest myths about menopause that you find yourself correcting most often? And also, as it relates to mental health, let's talk about the connection that menopause and sexual health have to mental health.
Sure. So I think, you know, one of the things I believe is that, you know, every woman deserves a conversation about hormone therapy in the menopause transition. Not every woman is a candidate for hormone therapy, and not every woman wants hormone therapy. And I think, you know, menopause maps on top of aging, the aging process. And oh, by the way, menopause also maps on top of a bunch of other life things for women, children going to college, career change, taking care of parents. And so I sort of feel like it's this like perfect storm of all these things mm-hmm. that a woman is facing at one time. And so it's a challenge. And I don't like the word menopause, meaning it, you know, everything stops. But I do like the idea of sort of like pausing and really for women kind of taking inventory of all the things going on in her life, whether or not it's symptoms related specifically to the reduction of ovarian hormone production, whether or not it's symptoms relating to aging, whether or not it's symptoms related to all the other things going on in her life. And for sure, you know, mental health is a huge part of that. And if your mental health is not at a place where you're really able to be not only reflective about how you're feeling and how you're doing emotionally, but you're not at a place to kind of have the tools, the necessary tools to really chart a course of wellness, not just for the next 5 years, but for the next 20 years. So it can really be this mm-hmm. inflection point in women's lives. And depending on what she brings to the table, physically, emotionally, what's going on in her family or the world around her, you know, that's really going to help either set her up for success or not. We know that women who enter menopause, who have a history of, for example, postpartum depression, mm-hmm. premenstrual syndrome disorder, you know, those other times in their lives where hormones kind of are fluctuating, we know that the menopause transition in that population specifically will probably have a harder time from a mental health standpoint mm. with the hormonal fluctuations or the, you know, the decline in hormones related to menopause specifically.
And how important do you think it is for women to have a healthcare provider who truly partners with them during this stage of life rather than simply just treating the symptoms?
Yeah. So again, I think that, you know, seeing an OBGYN who has some expertise in hormone management is, it should be one person on your team, but there should be other people on your team. So that could include your primary care provider. It might be seeing a cardiologist because you had, you know, you have certain risk factors mm-hmm. from a cardiac standpoint. It might be seeing a sleep, you know, specialist because sleep is really an issue related to your, you know, your well-being. It might be that you see a pelvic floor therapist because you're having some incontinence problems. It might be that you also see a therapist. And so I do think, you know, a team approach is really sometimes necessary. And sometimes, you know, women in general are pretty healthy or they see their OBGYN as their primary care provider for so many years because they've been pregnant or on birth control. Mm-hmm. And now they've come to a place in their life where they really actually need some additional, you know, resources, some additional folks on their team to, again, chart that course for wellness, not 5 years down the road, but for 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah. And actually, I'm going to shift gears here and talk a little bit about your own team, own clinical team on the home front. Your husband is also a physician and serves as regional chief clinical officer at the network while specializing in infectious diseases. What has it been like building both a marriage and a family while navigating two very demanding medical careers?
Yeah.
Because you guys are kind of, you know, in a special category all unto themselves. So yeah. Talk to me a little bit about that and what that looks like at home yep. as well as on the work front.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, Tim and I, we met our first day in medical school and, you know, kind of, you know, became partners in medical school and got married during residency. And then we had our first child when I was a third-year resident in Boston. And when we were finishing up, kind of deciding where to go, where to move, we knew we wanted to have more kids. We knew we needed help to do that. And so it was sort of kind of making a decision to go back where I came from or to go where Tim was from. And Tim is the oldest of six kids. Mm-hmm. There's five boys and the youngest is a girl. And we knew that we both needed to work. I mean, we had a lot of debt at the time, and we knew we really couldn't afford to stay in Boston. We were both very happy there, you know, kind of, you know, academically and in our hospitals where we were trained. But we really knew we couldn't really just make it work there. So, in thinking about who would be best able to sort of help us, we ended up coming to Allentown and being in the Lehigh Valley. And I think having that network of support was just, you know, really made everything possible. I mean, there's no way we could have been successful without my in-laws, without Tim's brothers. His sister was incredibly always able to come. And, you know, they were never our primary caregivers for our kids, but they were the ones that we called when somebody got sick or we needed help dropping off or picking up. And to be honest, we sort of like won the lottery with him being the oldest child because nobody else had kids. So our kids are the oldest. And so we fully took advantage of that. And I think it really, you know, it was really important for me to have kind of that layer of support and help for my kids. And I think that I'm hoping that they have a very special relationship with their, you know, aunt and uncles and, you know, grandparents sort of because of that. And it really, it takes a village. And, you know, we could not have done it, you know, unless, you know, we won the lottery or something. We just couldn't have done it without that family support for sure.
It does take a village, and thank God for the support system. I'm sorry, what were you?
No, well, I was just going to say that, you know, I think Tim, you know, he trained at Mass General, and, you know, he could have had a very, you know, kind of glorious academic career there, but he also really valued that, you know, the family and that we needed to kind of be someplace where we had that support. And one of the things I always think back is pretty funny. When we moved to Lehigh Valley, I had a job with a group at the time, and Tim didn't really have a job, and the hospital kind of like created a job for him. And, you know, he was working doing general ID, and we both were just working almost like every other weekend. And I always said to my boss, because I knew sort of what, you know, kind of what all the things that Tim brought to the table. And I always told my boss that I really married up. And that, you know, the network would soon realize that, you know, they kind of hired me. They made a job for Tim, but they actually really wanted Tim. And I think that, you know, over time he's sort of built a great career here and it's been an asset to the community.
Yeah. And I mean, listen, we're so grateful you guys are here, right?
Well,
I mean,
thank
you're
you.
Providing groundbreaking work in the OBGYN and menopause field. And Tim is actually, you know, he led us through COVID, you know, during the pandemic. So that, as you know, with his experience and expertise and specialty in infectious disease, as a physician, educator, and wife, and mother of three, what lessons have you learned about balancing career ambitions and family priorities? I mean, you mentioned your support system, but I mean, certainly with the demanding careers, how did you balance it all?
Well, I think, you know, that concept of balance, people talk about that a lot. And I think I kind of like throw that out the window. Like it was never balanced per se. It was never like 50-50 between, you know, Tim and I. We always, you know, I think had common goals. I think that you let go of some things like I'm a terrible cook. I'm a terrible cook, and I have never been a great cook. And, you know, I outsource things when I could. I had a cleaning lady that helped. But I did have always tried to, and Tim the same, you know, find some space to have, you know, to be present for the kids, try to make, you know, the soccer games. Unfortunately, I was never the one who could be, nor Tim, you know, be the homeroom mom or, you know, kind of be present in that way. When we moved here, you know, I didn't have any obviously friends here, and my kids went to a school, and I always felt like a lot of the moms, you know, didn't work, and so I sometimes felt a little bit more like an outsider. Certainly, I had women where I worked that, you know, worked, but sometimes that was hard, and I think I wonder if my, you know, kids, well, I know that they noticed it and still like remind me, well, you know, we were extended care till like 5:30, but you know, I try to remind them, especially I have two daughters and a son, the girls, that it's important to sort of, you know, make your way and take care of yourself. And you know, they were always fed and clothed. But you know, I missed a lot of birthdays and family events because of work. And, you know, it's just, you know, I try to explain that and, you know, have them see the value of, you know, sort of having a career.
Mm-hmm. And what advice would you offer you know, young girls that are looking at a STEM career and are maybe considering something in science or medicine, but aren't sure if they belong in those spaces because of societal norms or whatever else. What advice would you give them?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is, you know, to sort of be true to yourself and your interest, and then to find, you know, you only need one person that, you know, is a support person for you, that pushes you or gives you some confidence, and lean into that and rely on that and sort of keep your true north, that if you want to do something, you know, if you've got somebody that has your back,
mm-hmm.
I think that's the most important thing. And if you don't, to try to find that person, whether or not it's a teacher or a family member, I think that's the most important thing.
And if you look back and you think to you, and you want somebody to kind of remember you for something, what legacy do you want to leave behind, and what advice do you offer others that are in maybe a clinical role or a leadership role? What advice would you offer?
Yeah, I think when I think back about what's sort of most important to me, and not just, you know, in at work, but even in life, is really relationships, and to spend some time building relationships in whatever role you are. If you're just on the ground kind of doing your thing, or if you're a leader, I think getting to know who you're leading and being curious about that versus just sort of like making statements from above, that's the most important thing. And I think that's when real work gets done, is through relationship building.
Yeah. Today's conversation reminds us that healthcare is about much more than diagnoses and treatments. It's about relationships, education, trust, and empowering people to live healthier lives. Dr. Friel's journey from Wellesley College and Harvard Medical School to becoming one of our region's most respected voices in women's health is inspiring. But perhaps even more inspiring is her commitment to helping women understand that menopause is not an ending. It's a new chapter that deserves attention, support, and informed care. Dr. Friel, thank you for your leadership, your advocacy, your service to our community, and for helping women navigate some of life's most important transitions with confidence and dignity. Thank you again for joining us on Trailblazers. It's been a sincere pleasure.
Sure, anytime.